Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching the Romanoffs. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
We are midway through our examination of the Amazon series, The Romanoffs, from Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner. This week, we will be talking about episode 4, Expectation, written by Semi Chellis and directed by Matthew Weiner. At the end of the episode, we will have an interview with the episode star, actress Amanda Peet.
The great Amanda Peet. I love her.
I do love her, and I think she's amazing in this. And this is the episode that I've been teasing as like my favorite of the whole series. So I'm really excited for us to talk about it. I did also want to send out a call for emails, you know, despite the fact that Richard and I went a little, off beat last week, off the beaten track to assess our feelings about things. I got like one or two, salty tweets, but we did not get any, emails. So just want to say, if you want to email us your more complete thoughts about anything, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I will happily read them out loud. If you are fine with our thoughts on everything and just want to sit back and relax and listen to us, then that's fine too.
Hey, baby, just let it roll.
Let it wash over you. But this is an episode, that is largely focused on Amanda Peet as a woman who is expecting her first grandchild, from her, you know, her daughter is young. She had her daughter when she was young. So she's a very young, expectant grandmother. It also co-stars Mad Men alum John Slattery, this is the first sort of interconnected thing, because we saw this character crop up in episode 2, sort of giving a presentation about the Romanoffs on the cruise ship that Carrie Bechet's character went on. So this is the first like crossover character.
And he references episode 3.
Right, the miniseries that they're making.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he wrote the book that the minis, he's like, yeah, they're making it into a show in Europe, but I want to write it, but you know, so I guess this is Weiner kind of tying some knots together.
Yeah, but it's honestly, I think it's the most, and maybe that's apropos for episode 4. I haven't seen episode 5 nor episode 8, but I will say from the other episodes that I've seen, this is the most like interconnected. And it's still very light, I would say. So this is a day in the life of Amanda Peet's character, Olivia Wells, and the writer of the episode, Semi Chellis, has said that it is based on, loosely on Mrs. Dalloway, this Virginia Woolf's novel about, you know, this woman's, a day in the life of this woman who is sort of reflecting back on her life and what might have been if she had taken made other choices in her life. I absolutely loved this episode. I loved it as a showcase for Amanda Peet. What did you think of this episode, Richard?
I thought it was good. I was so enamored of episode 3, for all its ghosty, weird, behind-the-scenes stuff, that this felt like not a come-down exactly, but a return more to the show's kind of more literal, I mean, I hate to invoke him, but like Woody Allen-sized kind of thing, which isn't necessarily, I don't think that's bad. I mean, in that I liked the first two episodes as well, but I think that for me, that this episode was kind of make or break depending on who played Olivia, and that it was Amanda Peet is great, because like I said, I love her. I've been a fan of hers since, I don't know, God, Jack and Jill, remember that WB show?
Yes, sure do.
She is best friends with Sarah Paulson because of that show. I loved her in Igby Goes Down, and she's had a weird career where, and she's talked about this, where, you know, she's had a hard time finding something that quite lands, you know, or lasts for her. And I think most recently she had Togetherness on HBO, which was a Duplass Brothers show with Melanie Lynskey and other people, and that lasted two seasons and went away. So anyway, that's all. I just like seeing her in this kind of role, and she's really good in it. And even though if it's another sort of study of, you know, sort of wealthy ennui.
I really like the roles that she's been choosing for herself. I think there was a time in Hollywood where she kind of either tried to or was, because of where she was in her career, slipping into these like very light comedies. She did like a rom-com with Ashton Kutcher. Like, you know, there's the Whole Nine Yards era of her career. Like, there's all this stuff that Amanda Peet did. But like, what she's been doing lately, I think, is really challenging herself. And in my opinion, she's risen to the challenge in every single regard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A huge Peet head myself. But yeah, there were some surprises for me in this episode, though. I was unfamiliar with the actress Emily Rudd, who plays her daughter, Ella, who gets this nice, you know, she hasn't been in much, so it's okay that I don't know her very well, but like, she doesn't, get much in the meat of the episode, but she gets these nice bookends where you see her like at a lunch early on with her mother, and you have one idea of who maybe she is, pampered, superficial, possibly, or whatever. And then you get this just incredible final closing scene between these two women, this understanding, because the plot of the episode is sort of about this Olivia character wrestling with the truth that her daughter's father is not her husband. And it's something that only, you know, John Slattery's character, Daniel Rhys, is her husband's best friend and her daughter's father, because they had a tiny little affair when they were very much younger. And it's something that she's never told anyone, but John Slattery's character, Daniel Rhys, definitely knows, because his daughter looks so much like his mother. But she's never said it. She's never said it to her husband. She's never said it to her daughter. And now this grandchild is coming, and it's like the Daniel character knows it's his grandchild, but he can't say anything. Just as we see in flashback, he was at her wedding, but like couldn't say anything. And, you know, that's a fairly like melodramatic soap opera-y potentially sort of thing. But I think it's just done, via flashback, via unspoken words, via conflict, in a way that feels really rich. And in the end, the like sort of O. Henry-esque twist. I don't know why I keep looking for O. Henry twists in these stories, but the twist of this episode is that, you know, her daughter knew. And when the Olivia character, you know, is in the hospital, her daughter's like, "Do you want me to call him?" And just calls the Daniel character, her father. Yeah. And so she knew. And that, I mean, I don't know. It really, really very much got me. What did you think of all of that?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in all that, obviously, is where the kind of legacy comes in. You know,
right?
Why is this story part of this series about people who think or are related to a murdered Russian dynasty? Well, because John Slattery's character is, and so it's kind of this secret daughter, this kind of this continuation of the line that no one really knows about. And then when that person is having their own child, and thus the line is continuing, it causes this kind of minor crisis for both people about, like, you know, what does this mean? And basically, what does parentage mean? What does lineage mean? You know, does it matter, it really, at the end of the day, that the man who raised her is not this woman's biological father? Like, what, you know, I don't think that the episode is really getting into questions of like what fatherhood is at all, but I think that it's just kind of questioning the premise, I guess, in a way, of the whole series, which is like, where does it matter, like, where, like, what people you're from, why does it matter what people you're from? Isn't it all sort of circumstantial and just how you were raised? And even then, we see this initial conflict between the daughter and the mother, where she was raised she was raised wealthy, but she was raised with a certain set of values about work and whatever. And she's gone against that. So, whether that's maybe her old Romanov blood coming in, where she just wants to be, you know, pampered in a palace, I don't know. But, I think it's an interesting, like look at what, the sort of legacy of ancestry means.
I think all that's true. I had a slightly different understanding of the plot, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I thought it was Olivia's husband who was the Romanov, and John Slattery's character, Daniel, is just, like, interested in the Romanovs, but not actually Romanov. And that's why you get that conversation between Diane Lane, like that Diane Lane cameo as her, like, basically sister-in-law. And she's bringing this, like, elaborate right. christening dress, because I think that side of the family is the Romanovs. And I think the, our main character, Olivia, is feeling this weird guilt because she's like, she is allegedly furthering the line with another Romanov, with his granddaughter, right. but like she knows that this is not a Romanov baby because it's
right. So
yeah.
So and I feel like the thing still stands. Yeah. Like just like what does it really matter?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know there was a whole thing about and I should have researched this before even bringing it up, but there's something about how I think the Romanov family. There's a whole thing about how like they actually weren't Romanovs for like generations because one of the czars or whatever was so inbred that he was sterile, and so his wife like slept with somebody else and got pregnant, and so like the line actually died like many generations previous to the people who were murdered in 1917. Uh-huh. Don't quote me on that.
I'm gonna
like,
quote you
if
on
you
that.
Wanted to look, yeah. So anyway, I just think it's interesting. Yeah. Okay. I think yes. Now that you bring it up, yeah. John Tenney's character, he's the Romanov, but still, I think it's an interesting sort of idea. And I think that the anxiety that particularly Olivia is feeling in the episode, it feels human sized. It's not, you know, there's a scene where she walks out of her beautiful walk-in closet and confesses everything to her husband, and he's so nice and supportive, and like she says, "I know," you know, he's sort of, it's almost like he forgave her years ago. And I was like, okay, like that's, I guess, you know, well acted, whatever. But then it turns out to have just been a fantasy, and instead she just kind of lets things lie. And I think that's so much more realistic and says a lot more about the characters. So I appreciated the subtlety of this episode.
Yeah, I really loved that fantasy thing. Usually I can smell those coming. You know what yeah. I mean? Like when you're watching an episode, you're like, oh, this is just all in their head. And actually they fooled me for a little while. And it was actually, I was minorly devastated when it reset. And I was like, she did this brave thing. And like, of course his reaction was like way too positive. And it, like, of course it couldn't be. But I think what's so effective about that is the cut back to, mm-hmm. Her character, the Olivia character, like back in her changing closet or whatever, having
with her wet hair.
Yeah. Having not been brave enough to do this, you know, and yeah. it's just like, it's devastating. There's also like, you know, we keep reminding each other that this is a comedy. There's also like a good amount of comedy in this episode, chiefly like due to her doing some day drinking, I think. And I think Amanda Peet's really good. This is a really good sequence where she basically gets angry at these younger people who are snickering at her as she's having her solo beers.
Can I say something about that scene?
Yeah, of course.
All right, so that's the Flatiron. That's like Madison Square Park area. That is directly across the street from my therapist's office, where I will go later today as of recording. Uh-huh. If there was a nice like outdoor place where you could sit and get a drink right there, like, I would know about it. That's fake. There's no such thing. It's like, just a bunch of blocks. So they fudge that. But anyway, I will say about this episode's New York geography is they did it right. You know, I think that it's kind of funny thinking about how Mad Men in a way was often so hampered by the fact that they filmed in LA. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't really have street scenes. And also it was period. It would have cost a ton of money to dress up an actual New York street to look like how it needed to look. But just in terms of what subway she's getting off of and when she leaves that place where she's getting the beer, where she ends up, it's like, yep, that's where she would have walked to. Like, that, you know, that's right near there. So they were very careful about the geography making sense, which is a tiny, tiny sort of detail that no one really cares about. But, like, I appreciated it.
Well, you mean there's not a place with a plug in a bush in the middle of downtown New York? Well,
I would also like to know if that existed, too, because I could make use of that.
I would definitely plug my phone into a bush if I could. And then we should say that sort of sequence continues into her going to the airport to pick up her in-laws, you know, which just I want to mention because I believe that Mary Kay Place is always welcome in any film or television series. And so she shows up as the mother-in-law of this woman's daughter, and you know, it's just there to be kind of like genially baffled by whatever it is that Olivia is working through. But always welcome Mary Kay Place.
Oh, absolutely. She's also one of the best. I met her once. She's very nice.
Oh, nice. I have to wonder. I love this episode also just for there's all this guilt, all this what if, or what might have been, or what should I have done. But then there's also just, I think, this very natural and relatable, as you say, sort of human-sized drama of trying to grapple with, you know, a young woman, which is what I would consider Amanda Peet still to be, becoming a grandmother. I think we've all bumped up against this thing where it's like, I'm not ready to be this age, you know, whatever this age is or whatever this means for other people. I'm not ready to have the label of grandma put on me. I'm not, like, for me, I think the last time I remember this happening is either like when all my friends started having babies or like when like your first like hardcore wedding season and you're like, oh, I'm of the age where people get married. Like this is a thing that happens.
I think also, I don't have children, and probably won't, but, I think that what that scene with Mary Kay Place where she's talking about, the great thing is like, you don't have to discipline them. Like they love you more than their parents. You're talking about having a grandkid and how great it is to have a grandkid. And then, you know, you contrast her excitement about it with Olivia's anxiety about it, partly because she's young and her daughter's young. But I think that in some ways it's also a thing where when your child has their own child, something is closed, like a section and sort of it ends, you know, where you're now, the focus is now on this new child, this one removed from you. And I would think that in some ways it makes you feel like the narrative of your parenting is over, you know, in a big way. So I think that there's certainly anxiety about that, especially when you're as young as Amanda Peet is or Olivia is. I think it's another interesting look at what lineage is and what we pass down if her daughter's existence is premised on a lie, does this new baby born of this lie bring something with it into the world? Like, is there a stain on it or something? And that's never explicitly stated in the show or in the episode as a worry, but I feel like it's kind of hovering in the background.
Yeah, and there's also this thread of can you love two people, which is something that I feel like I've seen explored either like in a shallow way or rather disingenuously. But to me, this feels like a really authentic treatment of like, this is a person, this is a woman who sees two lives she could have had with two men, both of which, you know, she has this great life that she's had with this character played by John Tenney, that she's like, this is my husband, this is the father of my child, this is like, you know, this is a life that has mattered and been worthwhile to me. But there are a number of encounters, you feel the chemistry with her between Amanda Peet and John Slattery, and there's this great scene that's set several years in the past, you know, where she, like, it looks like she almost said something and didn't. And once again, that's something that I feel like could be so cliche, but is done so elegantly in this story that I found it really poignant. What did you think of that thread?
Yeah, no, I think poignant is the right word. And I think that, I know that he didn't write the episode, but I think that Weiner is so good at small moments of a sort of curious off angle poignancy.
This feels like the perfect opportunity to go to our interview with the great Amanda Peet.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thank you, Amanda Pete, so much for joining us. I wanted to kick off by asking you, I had read somewhere that this episode was based on Mrs. Dalloway, and I was wondering if you and Matt had discussed that when shaping this performance or how that influenced your portrayal.
He didn't tell me that. I've actually never read Mrs. Dalloway, embarrassingly. And we didn't talk about that. That's so fascinating.
This connective tissue between the episodes of this idea of the Romanovs, what is the significance of that in your mind?
In this episode, I thought it was, you know, a very subliminal theme, this idea of lineage and legacy and what you're going to inherit. And I think that's part of what's so beautiful about her anxiety, you know, about becoming a grandmother, the anxiety around how is the line going to continue? And also, how is the lying going to continue? Or what effect did that have? Mm-hmm. And but it's interesting because she really accuses her daughter of being bourgeois. But then in the end, you realize that's just her, you know, that wasn't a genetic, there wasn't necessarily a genetic component to that.
There's this theme that keeps coming up of sort of entitlement or exceptionalism. Like if you think you're secretly a Romanov, then you're secretly sort of exceptional in a way that mm-hmm. everyone else isn't.
That's why I think it's so stunning at the end when she basically says, I know who my father is. I know who my real father is. Yeah, that's part of why I think it's so beautiful at the very end.
I really love how it's bookended with these mother-daughter conversations and how that last moment of understanding is between mother and daughter. What did that mean to you?
It's the real story in the story is the I don't want to say love affair, but the relationship between the mother and daughter. And it was very, very poignant to me when I read it. And then when I saw it, I thought that it was what I thought he meant by it. And I think the moment when your child sort of sees you as a human being is, and not just like a parent figure or a parental unit, but rather they see you as a human being with your own heartaches and your own failures. I think that's very moving, especially between a mother and a daughter somehow. When I feel like I had that with my mom in real life, you know, when my mom got divorced, there was this immediate, our relationship became a mature friendship very quickly because I had terms with the fact that she was unhappy and therefore she wasn't just my mother. She was like a whole human being with a whole narrative and a whole future and a whole past. And to love her truly would I had to see all of that.
And I don't know if this is too personal a question to ask. I'm always wary of asking about people's kids, but I'm just wondering if doing this episode then made you think about what it would be like to have, you know, because your kids are still quite young, have your own kids sort of recognize you in that way.
Yes, it made me think that about that a lot. And, you know, I think it's much easier. It comes more quickly and more easily for children of divorced parents, I think, because the divorce forces everyone to, it shatters the parental unit, obviously, and all the illusions that that go along with that. So, you know, I hope that David and I don't ever get divorced, but I still want my children to know both of us, you know, truly know us when they're ready. It doesn't happen for, you know, until they're, I think it's better if obviously it happens when you're an adult, but I like in, I felt like Matt and Semi, the writers, they were really sort of pointing to that very moment when she realizes that her daughter is an adult and sees her.
And Matt is such an interesting and singular sort of creative person in the world of television. I was wondering if John, having worked with Matt for so long, gave you any sort of advice or preparation or whatever to working with Matt on this.
I mean, I heard that it was, you know, it was going to be, you know, like doing a play, like you can't improvise at all. And you know, he's very exacting and he has like a very strong point of view. And so I was very ready for all of that. And, and I was a really big fan of Mad Men. So I was, you know, I was more than happy to be that way, to try to, you know, do what he wanted me to do. Adhere to the vision, not fight him on it.
One of the reasons Matt has given for telling these sort of self-contained bite-sized stories versus a long-form serialized narrative is, you know, a lot of people right now are talking about this idea of too much TV. We're in peak TV. We're drowning in content. If you want to watch a show and you have to watch 20 hours, 30 hours of backstory, like it's just, it feels unapproachable. And I'm wondering, you know, what your thoughts are as a storyteller, about the current state of serialized TV. Is it exhausting to try to keep up with everything? What's going on?
Well, I guess that's no fun and can be really fatiguing, but I think what's really fatiguing is crap. So the fact is he's an incredible storyteller. And if you told me Joe Schmo was going to do an anthology series, I might not be as excited.
Absolutely. I've had way too much of Joe Schmo's work. What is it like then? Is there any difference to you working on an episode? You know, because I know John is in at least two of the episodes that I've seen, but there's very little connective tissue between the various episodes. But what does it mean to be in one part of an episode of a larger thing that isn't as connected as TV usually is?
I don't care, really.
Fair enough.
I just wanted to not suck in my part, and I was assuming that and continue to assume that Matt has taken care of the rest, which is whatever tenuous connections there are between these actual people or thematic connective tissue there is. And but I didn't involve myself in that.
And then, so then in the endeavor of not sucking, which you did not suck, What was sort of the most challenging aspect of making the episode?
Such a big question for me right now because I'm trying so hard to become a better actor, and it just has to do with the ability to stay improvisational within the constraints of the line and the scene and the character. And that's always lately the most challenging thing for me is basically don't be fake.
Is there something recent that has motivated you to try to push yourself to a different level if you think there is a different level you want to be on?
Well, I think working with the Duplasses was a game changer for me because I guess I felt like I hadn't been past the ball in a while in a real way, and in the beginning, it was really hard for me to trust them because I was just so used to not trusting anyone. And so I think that I was used to holding back a little bit and trying to control my performance more often. And they really forced me to let go because they really push you. They really push you. You know, I think I've talked about this before, but I mean, they even say, like, we want you to go off the rails. And they wanted it to be their job, whether I became fake or not, to be the, you know, the gatekeepers. They wanted to be the gatekeepers. They didn't want me to do that. And it, it was the first time in a long time that I really felt like, okay, I'm going to just do that.
Right.
I'm going to let go.
Yeah. How does that then translate over into working on this?
I think you have to let yourself be bad. You have to let yourself be bad in some takes and it set a precedent for me that I now don't want to go back on being with the Duplasses.
Are there other TV or filmmakers on your radar who you want to work with in a way that you think will push you in those good Duplass ways?
Yeah, there are tons of people I'd love to work with.
If Matt has already talked about how he wants to do more Romanoffs with Amazon, is that something that you would want to come back and do another episode of, or do you feel like you want to leave that story right where it is?
Okay, let me just put it to you this way. If Matt called me and was like, hey, I know it's the dead of winter, but would you mind coming to Winnipeg? I can't give out the script because it's a secret, but just come here and shoot. I would, like, get a babysitter and go.
Okay, fair enough. Whatever it is. You're not allowed to wear a coat. Please come to Winnipeg. Yeah. Got it. You're like, I'm there. Excellent.
No offense to Winnipeg. I didn't mean to.
No, you just thought of a cold place. Frigid cold place.
Yeah, I was just like, where would it be really hard to shoot outside?
Thank you so much for chatting with me. I really, really appreciate it. And I loved this episode. So I'm excited for everyone to see it.
Thank you very, very much.
All right. Well, I think that is everything we want to say about this great episode. Richard, until next week, where can people find you?
Oh, just wandering Manhattan, looking for a nice place to sit outdoor and have a little autumnal beer. I'll also be on Twitter at Rylaws and on VF.com. Where will you be?
You can also find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me trying to find a plug in any bush I see on the street. And we will see you next week to talk about episode 5 of The Romanoffs.
Yeah, Romanoffs.
I'm Olga Romanoff.
Michael Romanoff.
He said he was a Romanoff?
You know, she's a Romanoff.
Checking in for Romanoff.
I'm a Romanoff. I'm so tired of this Romanoff shit.
Nicholas Romanoff.
I could be a Romanoff.
He's a Romanoff too.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.